You're listening to a podcast from 702 and Cape Talk.
7 minutes after 11, this hour we're going to explore the question, how do you build anti-racist organizations? And I can't think of a better guest than Terry Oakley-Smith, who's with me, the Managing Director of Diversity, who has been doing this work for the longest in a very good way. She's absolutely brilliant at it. And over and above that, as I said, at 9 o'clock, just a wonderful excuse for a human being. Terry, thanks so much for coming in again.
Thank you, and thanks for that lovely introduction, Eusebius. I can feel myself blushing.
It is entirely sincere, and you know you're good, and you're also very generous. Obviously, I saw Terry's comment on Facebook. She said, well, maybe I should offer 702 anti-racism training. And I said, oh, cool. Well, let me get on the show then. So that's why we're talking, because it's off the back of the tweet that was sent from a social media account that was obviously a grossly unacceptable tweet. But I also, and I'm not running away, and Terry's going to ask me some awkward questions that she's asked me already. I'm not interested in protecting Prime Media, but I do think, as I said on Facebook last night, there is a South African story that is implicated in my life, Terry's life, your organization. No one is exempted. You're not exempted if you're at Power 98.7, if you're at ENCA, if you work for the Sunday Times, for the Star, for N7, wherever you are. You're not exempted in other parts of corporate South Africa. Terry and I have both done organizational cultural work in many parts of the South African corporate space. I have had talented friends, including some youngsters that she knows who are friends with her son, who have had to leave some law firms as a matter of mental health, for example, in Sandton. I have some friends who had to leave companies in the financial sector who are now household names in their public careers, but they had to leave because of corporate racism. And I've had some friends who've had to leave media companies because media companies don't have policies that take seriously their own mental health challenges that they might be having. So South Africa is a mess, and we're all implicated in that mess. And that's why I wanted Terry to come on. I'm not sure what the right starting point is, but one of my favorite people in our community of listeners is Citizen Nina. And she just called in our conversation we had with Jacques Rousseau just now and said, why do we always talk about race, Eusebius? You know, there's such a bias. We never talk about sexism, which in volume might be quite higher. So I wanted to ask you a preliminary question, Terry. Should the framing question for this hour be something like, how do we develop organizational cultures that are anti-racist? Or should we now in this day and age really begin to live the intersectional story and frame it differently, something along the lines of, how do we build organizational cultures that are inclusive and just?
I was thinking exactly that. And in fact, since people heard that I was going to be talking on your show today, they also asked me, why are you always, not that I'm always, but why do you mainly talk about race? What about gender? What about people living with disabilities? Why can't we talk about inclusivity? But I think the fact that that tweet was sent on Sunday, and there has been such a furore about it, Eusebius, and Prime Media has handled it in the way it has, or rather left it to its presenters to handle it in the way they have, I think perhaps race should be our jumping off point. Okay. But I don't think we can only talk about race.
So we're not going to stop there.
No. We talk exactly as you said about a just workplace and an inclusive workplace.
Now let's firstly talk about my workplace, because you are very generous about our station, the work we do, this particular show as well. So I know that you have a generosity with which you observe what goes on in a company like Premedia and 702 as a radio station. But even on my wall yesterday, you were saying that the way it was handled, including on air, was not adequate in your opinion. As an expert on diversity and inclusivity, what are your thoughts?
Well, my thoughts are that it was rather left up to the presenters, you, Kolani, Azania, Bongani, to deal with it. And what was missing was us all realizing this was actually a company issue. It was Prime Media who made the blaps. And I asked myself, you know, how can a big company, what is Prime Media doing about racism, Eusebius? It's not enough to just have very well-educated and thoughtful presenters on air. What is it actually doing back home as a company? Does it have clear-cut policies? Does it have clear-cut practices? What education, or what was this young woman told before she was let loose with a camera to make tweets on such an important day for 702, which you've been talking about for so long? Was she taken aside? Is there a policy on anti-racism in prime media? I mean, I think that I got the impression that the presenters were very anxious to shield her in a way. And I think her story is very interesting, that the tweet was from a young black woman, and we can talk about that a little bit later on. But it said to me, I wonder if Prime Media is doing enough to create an environment which is non-racist. Does it have policies in place? Does it have practices in place? Does it have processes in place? Is it training people, just as it trains them in how to be on air or whatever, is it training them in the kind of image it wants to project and the kind of people it wants them to be? And I just suspected that it was all thrown in your laps, and you did a very good job, the four people that I've mentioned. But Prime Media doesn't come out covered in glory.
The CEO of the company, of the broadcasting division of the parenting company, was on Kulani's show. I thought he was I thought he was compelling in taking it on the chin. And of course, you know, I mean, I don't suck up to anyone. I'd rather be unemployed than suck up to anyone. But I have to say that there are very few media houses where, or companies in general, that would be comfortable with Eusebius and Terry deconstructing his place of employment, or to do what I did yesterday, Kulani did, or to even generously listen and take seriously the remarks of someone like Reedy Tlhabi, who's been here 10 years plus and is not here anymore, and who tweeted also very thoughtfully on the issue. And of course, Bongani and Azania as well. Does that not count for anything, or do you still, is that not enough? That doesn't deal with institutional issues, does it?
No, it doesn't deal with institutional. I mean, what would happen if you had, I mean, I actually did seriously wonder if you would resign, or if one of you would grow a pair and say, I don't want to be associated with this, with a radio station, with a company that puts out this kind of tweet.
Did you think the issue was of that magnitude? Because I have I've one or two black friends who are deeply, deeply committed to anti-racism, who said privately on a WhatsApp group, and I won't, don't worry, I won't mention your man, but he's a very close friend of mine. Racism riles him up. And he said to me, ah, you know what, Eusebius, I'm actually fed up with some of black people's response to this permanent victimhood that we are performing. And he does take race seriously. I don't agree with him. I think that the anger is legitimate. Mm. But what I don't have a handle on, and I want your view, is the magnitude of the moment. Is it a Penny Sparrow type moment, or is it a moment in the news cycle that is just another example of the fault lines of the entire society?
Well, I think it's a moment for me because the person who put out the tweet is black. And what it said to me is that in an organization like Prime Media, black people have been assimilated to the extent, or it might have been before, it might have been when she was at school, I don't know anything about her, but somewhere along the line, Prime Media hasn't done much with this young intern to inculcate in her their own values. And it also worries me about the fact that there are black people who have so assimilated this white cultural position around dogs, for example, or they don't see anything wrong with posting dogs and babies and making a comparison when the babies are black, that she just didn't see it. That was the moment for me. Oh, my God, it's not only us whites now, but even black people have assimilated these perspectives. We've given them these perspectives. Mm-hmm. And that's where companies and schools, there's been a big issue at St. John's College. Teachers still working there. And I think that's where companies have a real responsibility, especially when people come in as young interns, to really help them to be able to integrate and to be able to be who they really are, and not to feel that they've got to suddenly put on a different hat and be a different person because they're now in prime media.
But I think this is the nub of the issue, which is both exciting and awkward all at once. It's creatively exciting, even though it's painful. Mm. Because what you are describing goes to the heart of how institutional histories work everywhere in this country. Mm. I've worked with some clients where the leadership in the board of the company was shocked once a diagnostic had been done with proper qualitative and quantitative research amongst the thousands of staff who don't look like the board members. And their idea, the board members' idea of what life is like in the company, turns out to be very different to the average Joe further down the organogram. So I want to ask you this before we take a break. This incident, is it exceptional or is it prototypical of what corporate citizens have not dealt with in general in this country?
I think it is in a way both. It's exceptional because it's the first time we've heard of a black person doing something which is as discriminatory as this was. But it also reinforces my view that it's so difficult still for black people who are vastly in the majority to really be themselves in organizations and who still feel they need to take on the whiteness in order to get anywhere. I mean, the number of tweets that said, I don't tell my boss what I really think because I'll be fired. If I said that, I would be fired. And I think that people are living in a kind of fear of being able to speak out, and especially when it comes to issues of race. I mean, the worst thing I can hear when I go into an organization is, we don't see race here. We don't even see color. As if that's something to be applauded. Instead of it, the message to me is, whoops, we've got a big problem here. They can't even see it.
Yeah. 19 minutes after 11, you're listening to the awesome voice and insights of Terry Oakley-Smith, and we're talking about how to build organizational cultures that are as egalitarian, just, and inclusive as possible. It is a complicated, difficult conversation. We don't shy away from that on this show. And one of the questions we will get to, but we couldn't get to that point until we've acknowledged the existence and the size of the organizational cultural problem, is how do you overall institutional norms and ethereal things like cultural habits? So let's take a break. Then Terry will drill down into that. And I'm also going to take your calls on the other side of this. Okay, so we are talking with Terry Oakley-Smith, who does incredible work around inclusivity and building organizational cultures that are more egalitarian and just. The starting point, unashamedly, as Terry says, even though she's committed to intersectional justice, is, of course, race. But we will expand it and talk about other aspects of our identities that need to be also allowed for and accommodated in the world of work. A lot of your tweets coming through are wonderfully affirming about her insights and her frankness. Bongani, my colleague, says, I always just want to hug Terry. Me too. Have I given you a hug yet? I did. We had a hug outside. Absolutely love her work. Tandy says, conversation is much needed. I'm glad you're devoting an hour to it. And then a couple of other folks saying, nodding my head in agreement with the great statements by Terry around assimilation in particular. Let's go to the lines, Terry. In Brakpan, we've got Barney. Barney, good morning and welcome to the conversation.
Hi, good morning. Thank you, Sarah. It was a wonderful conversation. I would like to ask a question based on the tweet and based on the OUTsurance ad, for example. And I asked the producer, is there a difference, or where do we draw the line? Because what has become black culture is mainly due to the suffering and our past. So Barney playing bare feet in a dusty field in Gelukdal has become culture. But that is not my culture. Yes, I would have loved to play on an astroturf with indoor boots, also in Gelukdal. So looking at these two incidences now, I'm just wondering that, are we ever going to get to a point where black people can also be associated that I also love to do bungee jumping and surfing and kite surfing? Because that's why the OUTsurance ad was controversial, because all the white fathers with the kids were doing all these extreme sports, and the black dad was playing, the one black dad that was in the ad, was playing with his baby in the living room, I think.
Yeah.
So for me, it is when we're going to be portrayed that we would have loved to do those things had it not been for the pressure that we suffered.
Yes.
And that's why, yes, I don't want to say the tweet was not insensitive, but I think in this person's mind, she might have reached a point where she can also see the cuteness in dogs and in kids, the same as a white counterpart who can post a picture about a baby and a dog and say, these are my babies.
Okay. Barney, I tell you what, delicious, delicious texture, what Barney is talking about, Terry, because when it comes to group identity in general, before we cascade the conversation down to organizations, I struggle with this. Not struggle, for me, it's like one of those lifelong curiosities. I believe in individualism. I am unashamedly a liberal individualist. And I think it's partly because if you're a member of groups that are subjugated, you understand the dangers of group identity and groupthink. And I want the space to be unashamedly me. I want to be me. I don't want to be oppressed by my Catholic church, in which I was raised, view on my sexual orientation. I don't want to be oppressed as a gay person by my community's dominant mores around homosexuality. I want to live in a world in which I can have a dog without Jacob Zuma telling me that I'm acting white. But it doesn't mean that there aren't group tropes and history around tropes, right? So how do you respond to that caller who isn't denying how that tweet landed, but he is also fed up with essentialist ideas about what it means to be black and white?
I mean, I think he's talking about a future that we haven't yet arrived in. I think we're still in a space where we know so little about each other as people of different races, cultures, religions, that what we have to fall back on are only our stereotypes. And that means that even in advertising agencies and in the media, when we're putting together advertisements, for example, we tend to fall back on the stereotypes rather than on our genuine knowledge of just how rich and diverse people of all racial groups are. And as you say, I mean, just assuming a person is black, therefore he doesn't, you know, he doesn't like dogs and, you know, he lives in Soweto and, you know, doesn't have a job. Yes, there may be many people like that, but there may also be many people who are only part of that, and there'll be many people who are very, very different. But I think we haven't got there yet. That's where we need to get, Barney. I agree with you completely. That's where we need to get. But we're so far from that still.
Absolutely. Let's go to Pretoria. TJ, good morning to you and welcome.
Hello.
Hello, TJ. Go ahead.
Hi, you see this. I'm actually commenting or calling to comment and to you and your guests, good day. Because whatever we're talking about this morning actually relates to an experience I had recently. And my worry comes into an institutionalized way or an unawareness from a black person who is being racist to another black person. And maybe because of my experience this past weekend, it's somebody who treats somebody who is white better than me, even though they are black, and they treat the other person who's white better than me, and they give them certain privileges, even though I'm supposed to legally or rather logically be the first in line. They actually push the other person further with a smile on their face without being aware that they're actually promoting the same racism that they're fighting against.
Oh, I mean, I think you've just raised such an important issue, TJ, and that is the extent to which inferiority has been institutionalized in many black people through apartheid. The psychological damage done to a whole race of people who were constantly reminded or told that they were inferior has become part and parcel of the actual mental makeup of some black people. And therefore, that explains exactly why this person who's also black like you feels that he must appease the white person more. Because in his mind, white is more important than black. He's actually
internalized oppression as well.
Internalized oppression, institutionalized sense of inferiority. And it's one of the main things that we need to be fighting against. In schools, in organizations, in the media like today, every day. It's a huge problem.
Absolutely.
Eusebius McKaiser on 702 and Cape Talk.
25 minutes before noon. I wish we had 2 hours. We are talking about how to build organizational cultures that are genuinely egalitarian, inclusive spaces for all the diverse individuals that we are when we meet in the working place in the morning. Let's go to Morningside. Lance, welcome to the show.
Hi, Scott. Hi, Eusebius. How are you doing?
Hey, my favorite twin. Don't tell the other one.
Yes, I like Teddy. I've been writing extensively on this issue, and I've almost been pulling my hair out in frustration of the lack of transformation. For me, transformation has become now a market force, and if businesses don't take it seriously, the market's going to take you out of business. If you look at just pure population dynamics, black people make up, I'm talking particularly black, 92.3% of the population. If your board is only representative of 8.3% of the population, that means that you're not representative of your customer base. And if you're not representative of your customer base, your customers are going to take you to the cleaners, and that's what's currently happening at the moment. And in order for transformation to happen, they have to change their business, the way of doing business, meaning that they have to look and not just look at the metrics in terms of brand and sense, but are we being transformative? So every meeting has to ask, are we being transformative? Every position you hire, it has to be, are we being transformative? Every engagement with your customer, with your supplier base, with the entire value chain has to ask, are we being transformative? And it has to be linked to people's bonuses. If it's not linked to it, we're just farting in the window.
And if it's not one of the top three, top five priorities of the CEO, it's going to die a death with Lance, the black person who's been entrusted with professional development or HR or something else. It has to be taken seriously at the top.
It has to be taken so seriously, it has to be an agenda item in every meeting right down the corporate chain. Because if it's not, we're just not taking it serious. For example, then, let's look at the mining sector. The mines have thrown a hell of a lot of money into development. I mean, take a company like Sibanye. They think I've paid 650 million rand into social development. That's more than they pay out in dividends in a year. Yet, are they transformative? So it's not about just putting resources into it, it's about asking them, are we aligning ourselves, are our values carrying out throughout the organization?
Absolutely. Good questions. Absolutely.
And this is what happened at Spur. They have a customer-facing organization that's not transformative, and they don't know how to deal with it. They just don't. You know, it's like they got pushback from a sector of the audience, and they're getting pushback from another sector of the audience, and they don't know what to do. And that should be the starting point. We don't know what to do. Help us out. That's where you start.
Thanks, Lance. That's Lance Claassen, who's written a lot about this for the Business Day. You might have read some of his stuff there and doing some really important work under his own company as well, trying to get companies to understand this. Let's actually puzzle through that, because you and I were talking exactly what Lance was talking about during the break, Terry. There's a cluster of issues here. Let's see whether we can go through them systematically. The first is, why, despite robust evidence that it makes business sense, quite apart from making moral sense, do companies not take transformation as seriously as Lance is saying, even though we now have evidence that it makes moral sense? I mean, how many more McKinsey, Quarterly, Harvard Business School studies do we need to prove that your bottom line is positively affected by taking seriously diversity?
Well, I think that one of the problems is, which Lance hinted at, or perhaps it was you, Eusebius, that it's not regarded as a serious issue by the CEO or the board. It's something that's handed down to usually to the HR department, and it's seen as a thing, maybe a once-off. Oh, well, let's have a diversity workshop, you know, as if one day can undo 20-odd, well, two, how many thousand years. So there's no seriousness to approach transformation as a process, beginning with actually understanding your own organization, as you said earlier on, Eusebius, doing the research on your organization to find out, because the diversity issues in your organization can't be the same as the diversity issues in another one. Yeah. Pick and Pay is not the same as Checkers. They have different diversity issues.
Yeah.
And then having identified what those are, customizing not just a program, but a program for staff at some levels, a program which trains managers. There are very clear ways of managing diversity, which managers in South Africa seem to know very little about. How do you reinforce? How do you monitor? How do you measure? And then the leadership. You know, if the leadership is not driving it, if the leadership is not really taking ownership of the process, then it really hasn't got a hope. And my experience is...
What's been your experience?
My experience has been very often come in and do a few workshops.
Yeah.
And that's not going to make any difference.
Yeah.
It needs to be internalized.
Absolutely.
It needs to be sustained.
And they probably think you're trying to tote for more, lots and lots of work permanently. Yeah, but probably. They've got to take it seriously. I've had a similar experience as you. And this one was interesting because I didn't want the job. I said to the person, I'm going to give it to you for free because I'm about to go back on radio full time. I don't have the space. And I outlined three things to them. I said, there are three different versions of how you can deal with inclusivity and organizational cultural work in terms of workshopping and turning around your company, Terry. And I said to them, first, let me call the first one the Skoro Koro version. In that version, you ask Eusebius and you say, Eusebius, come and make the white people uncomfortable for 40 minutes, field some questions, we'll pay you as a public speaker and off you go. And that's what they wanted me to do. And I said, guys, I can do that. It will be easy cash for me. Will you change your organization? No, you won't. You will just have riled up a couple of people by getting your favorite race commentator to come and rile them up. Then I said to them, there's a second version. Let's call it the BMW version, where you say to Eusebius, do some experiential workshops and use some tools in your organizational cultural toolkit that you have, and let's do at least three or four of that over the year. Now, that's a bit better than a one-hour lunchtime conversation. Then I said to them, that will make some difference, but there's a problem. In version two, the BMW version, you are asking Terry to come in cold without understanding who she's speaking to. And then there's the Rolls-Royce version, which I really shouldn't call that, because actually this is the only version that makes sense.
The only one that works.
You have to say to Terry, plot me, doesn't matter if you take 18 months or 2 years, a diagnostic process so that you develop and select from your toolkit of experiential stuff that you work with when you transform places, a set of tools that speak to the particularities of this particular firm. Mm. Because what will happen is if you ask Terry to do the BMW version, thinking that at least you're doing better than the Skoro Koro version, you're going to get that one person in the room who will say, but Terry, this is not true of Prime Media.
Yes.
This may be true of Spur, but not Prime Media. The women in this company love being here. And then Terry is disempowered because she can't say to them, let me tell you what the woman told me in the 12-month diagnostic that I've done. So how many companies that you have worked with have been prepared to walk the talk on the Rolls-Royce version?
Well, very few. Let me say that out of, say, 100 companies, probably 2 or 3.
Which means they don't take it seriously,
they don't.
Surely.
And the other thing that has to be added to that is how are we going to measure this process? At the end of year one, let's align it with the bottom line, because we know that diversity done effectively impacts positively on the bottom line. So let's measure it. Let's be sure. But this thing about, we've done diversity and we've invited Tom, Dick, Harry and Terry to come in and do, you know, a day, and then we assume we've done something. We've done nothing. And in fact, very often, Eusebius, the Skoro Koro and the BMW cause more problems because they surface anger, resentment, guilt very often, shame,
100%.
But they don't make any attempt to deal with it and to unpack it.
Absolutely.
So
and it's dangerous because you don't even have the space to build the safety container as the facilitator. I think anyone, quite frankly, I don't know how this industry works and who your peers are. I mean, I've done some work and I know the kind of work that you do. Mm. But I think anyone who takes their own work seriously, as tempting as it is to get the cash, should refuse to do that kind of work because it can damage your reputation. It can make the people at the top enjoy the illusion that they are actually taking transformation seriously, but you're leaving impaired workers behind.
Absolutely. And, you know, the idea of taking things off the shelf, come and do anti-bias training. Now, it might not even be a need in a particular organization. In fact, it's become quite discredited recently. But, you know, the kind of companies who think they know what they need and aren't prepared to let you, you know, who've been working in this area for 20 years, Eusebius. And I'm not saying that I don't have a lot to learn. I do have a lot to learn. But I know a process that can work if given an opportunity.
Absolutely. Dumisane, good morning to you. Welcome to the show. Hello, Dumisane.
Yes, a question for Terry. We know that the pervasive power of whiteness cuts through workplaces. Now, in building dynamic, high-performance work cultures, how do you empower people to become or remain authentic to their true selves and be brave enough to speak up against it when the cost of that could be, well, delayed? Lining, how do you do that?
What a lovely question. Terry, you were just lamenting to me how few black people you've discovered when you go into these companies who speak.
Absolutely, and one understands because they are in a situation, as Dumisane alludes to, where their job could be on the line if they are themselves. And that's why you have to work with the whole organization. You have to work with leadership. You have to work with management. And obviously, you have to work with staff. And you have to be able to, as a white person, own your privilege. White people need white people to tell them just how privileged they are. They're not going to listen to that from a Eusebius. They're not going to listen to that from a Dumisane. So we need to get people into the organization that can talk to all groups. We need black facilitators, but we also need white facilitators who can go to the hub and the core of the matter, which often they're afraid to do. And I understand, but I find it so often, Dumisane, that you know, I will make a statement around white privilege, and it'll be black people that are saying, oh, no, but, you know, I'm this and I'm that and I've got this and I've got that, and kind of denying that white privilege exists when we know very well that it's part and parcel of their experience every day.
100%. Lusanda, hello.
Hello, Eusebius. Please note that I can't hear you, but I'll make my comment. I think it's important to note that whiteness as a culture is something that people have aspired to achieve. And for us to say, actually, maybe we need to have workshops to sort of train people away from, you know, disregarding black people in organizations is just, I think for me, just one small part. The bigger part is actually economically, because if you know that within your organization, as white colleagues were all getting higher salaries than all the black people, it's very difficult to respect someone when you already know that you're occupying a superior position, even though you're doing the same job. So that is the first thing. And of course, black people in these institutions will aspire to be white and will aspire to assimilate what white people would think culturally appropriate. So being like a radical revolutionary young black woman in a white dominant organization is not going to get you anywhere. You actually need to be liberal. You need to be understanding of whiteness and as a dominant culture, you know, and that is why even in 702 you will hardly find a radical presenter. I mean, you won't have an Eric Mieni there. It wouldn't sit well with the aesthetic of the radio station. So I think actually it's economic and bringing in, you know, powerful forces which are not white, which is often not even considered.
Okay, we're going to leave it there, Lusanda. Let's take a break and then I'll get Terry to respond to you. I love you, Terry. Yes, you are an insight a second. Don't worry about that. We'll fix that. You can speak to Lusanda in the meantime.
Right. Yeah. I thought Lusanda's call was extremely interesting. I hope she can hear us now, Eusebius. Mm. I mean, that aspiration towards whiteness, I actually think that's changing. And I think that there's a whole younger generation out there that are not aspiring to assimilate. I think the generation before them has more or less been forced to assimilate because they were the first generation to be given any opportunities. But I can tell you it's not going to be for long that we're going to be holding the upper hand. I really don't think so, Eusebius. I see a lot of young, dynamic, black women in organizations, young black women, who are more than prepared to speak out and to live their lives as they really are, and not to be prepared to take on my accent and my way of dressing and my religious ceremonies or whatever. So I think it's not going to be for long. I think it's going to be sooner than we think. That South Africa's in for a big wake-up call around race.
Absolutely. Nicola, we just lost you there. I wanted to get you on, Nicola. I would love to hear what you think. I think that's you who also tweeted me. Let's see whether we can get Nicola. Okay, I don't know what's wrong with the line then, Nicola. Meanwhile, let's go to Santon. Nozzies, where? Hello.
Hi, Eusebius. Thanks for taking my call. So, Eusebius, I'm going to start with, you're one of my faves. I'm going to start with a bit of a criticism. I think that you, as well as the other presenters yesterday, were a tad bit on the offense, on the defensive side. And I think Terry already spoke to this already. There was a very, you all acknowledged from Golani how, problematic the tweet was, but then you didn't then take it further and say how this relates to an institutional reality within 702 and Prime Media. I think that, for me, has been the biggest omission and the biggest gap in the discussion.
Well, let me just say something on that, Nozizwe. I don't think that is 100% fair. I don't want to be sidetracked by my example because I want to hear your second thought as well. But just out of nerdish interest, I made the point yesterday without even knowing who my colleague is that I doubted that the black woman who tweeted that tweet would have tweeted the same tweet if she worked at Kaya FM or Power FM. If you go back to the podcast, I said it. And what I meant by that, if it wasn't abundantly clear, is that we perform institutional cultures depending on where we are. I mean, how much more of a connection between the tweet and institutional norms do you want me to spell out?
And the blame rests with Prime Media, not with presenters.
But your point's well taken, but I'm just saying for the record, I'm very aware that she might have curated, as they say, a different set of tweets had she worked for Mhlobo Buneni.
So, okay, point taken. But what I mean specifically, you see, for example, there's been a big omission in the discussions that I've heard, and obviously I'm not able to listen to what we say about the WhatsApp discussion between the 702 producers. If those have been authentic, correct?
Yes.
Okay. So, I mean, for me, that's actually where this discussion should be. It's not about the tweet that was sent out by that young black staff member is a result of that institutionalized nature of 702. That's the nub of this discussion. So in general, my larger critique of not only 702 and Prime Media, but in South Africa, is how we discuss the questions of how racism and white supremacy are institutionalized in our organizations. And it's everything from corporate SA right through to our universities, to our churches, our schools, wherever, until we start having very, very intelligent, nuanced discussions about how all of us are bathed in racism, how all of us are bathed in white supremacy. Obviously, it's different. So white people are the beneficiaries. Therefore, they have a different positionality to black people who are on the receiving end of it.
Yes.
But even people who are black and are on the receiving end of it can end up perpetuating a very, white supremacy and racism, as that young woman who sent out that tweet can.
No, but that's 100%, Nozizwe. You and I don't disagree one bit. The very heart of this hour was precisely about the connections between the personal and the structural, the personal and the institutional. There's no disagreement between you and me. And I think I would even go further than you and say that when we do talk about institutional racism, misogyny, we also must not anthropomorphize institutions, because the other thing we start doing, which is the second danger in these kinds of conversations, Nozizwe, is that you then find companies being happy to talk about institutional norms being broken and not inclusive because they don't think of the institutions as themselves. So we also then need to come back to the individual and say institutions just are comprised of real human beings, because sometimes institution talk also make people very emotionally comfortable because institutions are not living creatures.
So, okay, absolutely. But you see this, though, yesterday, you know what I was saying in terms of what I was a little bit disappointed in is that it just, you know, there was a bit of a veering. You did make that point about kayak and, for example, power. But then there was a bit of veering and saying that people are just, you know, you went off on a bit of a tangent about how people are voting and da-da-da-da-da-da about, you know, and basically just being too protective of the organization. And it's rather saying, guys, it's clearly a problem.
Oh, no, I know exactly what you're referring to. No, this is where we're going to have to ventilate that on another occasion because we're running out of time. But no, I do not take that back one bit. Some people have schadenfreude. Some people manufacture rage. Some people are genuinely enraged. Some people don't have this courage in their own workplaces. All of that, I still stand by.
Okay, so can I just make one last point about
10 seconds,
the main point where I called, right?
Yeah.
Yes. So bottom line, all of us are too we let ourselves and we let our institutions at an individual level and also at an institutional level, we let ourselves get away with murder because it makes us so uncomfortable to think of just how pervasive. I don't understand why people don't understand that supremacy in white supremacy means that it is supreme. So all of us are tainted by it. If we say, okay, if we use that as a starting point, how do you reverse engineer to a position where that isn't actually the case?
And okay, we're going to have to leave it there just in the interest of time. 20 seconds just from you, Terry.
I want to know what Prime Media intends to do going forwards. I think an apology isn't nearly enough, and I'd like to see them doing something about their own organisational culture and not putting their presenters on the hook all the time. But just to reply to Nosizwe, I think it goes back many, many, many years. We've done nothing for so long, and now we're drowning in the mess that we've arrived in, and we need to start acting very soon.
Thank you, Terry. You've been brilliant.